This is Not Your Grandma's Bible Study, making critical biblical scholarship accessible and fun.
Howdy do.
Welcome back.
This is Not Your Grandma's Bible Study. With Jill.
And Zach.
Not your grandma's.
Not your grandma.
All right. So this episode, we are going to talk about the book of Esther. And we're going to do a little differently. We're not going to take on a particular passage or anything like that. We're going to do a bit of an overview of what the book is about, its setting and things like that, with the idea that we will come back at some point and pick up a couple of passages, maybe for a further in-depth dive. So this episode is really going to be sort of just an overview of Esther. Should we start with just a little bit of an overview of the story of Esther? I mean, you can go and read it. It's not a super long book. Probably take you, maybe like an hour, if you're, depending on how slow you are. It's like 10 chapters.
It's pretty short.
It's pretty short. And so in this story, a king is married, wants his queen to come to this banquet and show her off. And she says, nope. So he gets rid of her, sends her out. And so then the king needs another queen.
Yeah.
Can't be king without a queen. And so he calls for all sort of the, you know, available women in the kingdom to come together, and he will, for essentially a beauty pageant, and then he'll decide which one he likes best. So it's like The Bachelor BCE.
Mesopotamian style.
The Bachelor Mesopotamia. That might need to be the episode title.
Yeah.
Bachelor Mesopotamia. Is Esther going to get the rose? Do we know? Anyway, so she goes, she's selected, and the subplot that's happening simultaneously is an advisor of the king wants to kill all of the Jews in the country, and he sort of tricks the king into signing off on this. And so Mordecai, the uncle and caregiver of Esther, finds out about this plot. And then the drama of the story is Esther's positioning as the new queen gives her opportunity to undo the plot and to save the Jewish people. So that's sort of the Cliff Notes version, and it works, of the story. So, and again, someday we'll come back and look at maybe a text or two in some bigger depth. So I've mentioned most of these people, but your key figures in this text, obviously Esther, it's named after her. She's an orphaned girl who lives with her uncle, who becomes queen.
Mm-hmm.
So real rags to riches story. Mordecai is her uncle and her caretaker. And he is the one who puts her in the best position to win, to become a queen, right?
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm.
And then we have the Persian emperor of the story. Ahasuerus is his name in the story. Probably Xerxes.
Yeah, Artaxerxes is probably who this is referring to, or supposed to refer
to. And then we have Vashti, who is Ahasuerus's disobedient and therefore dismissed wife. She's just briefly at the very beginning of the story, but she really shows considerable amount of willpower to be like, no, I'm not coming and doing that, and living with the consequences of that. Because she had to know.
You can't refuse.
You don't refuse the king, especially when he's drinking. So,
and then
we have Haman, who is the powerful official that has it out for Mordecai specifically, but the Jews in general. And so those are your big key figures within the text itself. So Esther has some questionable aspects for it being in the canon. First of all, it lacks any overt religious elements. There's no cultic worship. There's no prayers. There's no sacrifices. There's no mention of Jerusalem or the temple.
Mm-hmm.
There's not any acknowledgement of Jewish law, much less of following it. So for example, Esther marries a Gentile, and as we just discussed, intermarriage was punishable by death in some cases.
Yep.
And nobody's eating kosher.
Nope.
God is literally never mentioned.
Nope.
In this text, even though it does contain sort of this underlining theology of God's providence and faithfulness. And I think this is interesting. Esther is the only book of the Hebrew Bible, as we have it, that doesn't show up at Qumran. And I'm curious if that's intentional or just an accident of history.
Or we haven't found it yet.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it's pretty interesting that every other book in the Hebrew Bible is found, even if it's in like fragmentary, you know, minimally represented, not in whole or something. And Esther isn't, which again, it could just be an accident of history. But with some of the, you know, these religious elements being omitted, it might not have been viewed as worth maintaining in a textual way. Or, I mean, it's just thought of as like a good story, but like you don't keep it on your bookshelf kind of thing or whatever. So I think those are some of the interesting aspects of Esther writ large that I think make the fact that it's in the canon particularly fascinating. So a couple of, I guess, important aspects or things to be noted here. So the story is set, it is thought, in the reign of Xerxes. As we mentioned, Ahasuerus is probably Artaxerxes. So it's set in his reign, which is like 486 to 465 BCE.
Somewhere in there.
But it's written much later. It's written during the Babylonian exile, as most of the books come together.
As most of the Hebrew Bible probably was finished about that time.
And it's not, it's considered a fictional Jewish novella. Mm-hmm. So this is a way of thinking about I remember one time.
Story time.
I was trying to tell somebody that Esther is probably not a historical account. And uh-oh. I was told flat out I was not a Christian. Well, actually, I was asked, so then you don't believe Jesus is dead and resurrected? And I was like, those are two different conversations that you're having right now. Those are apples and oranges. So the reason that scholars don't think this actually happened, first of all, Artaxerxes never had a wife named Vashti. There's nothing in the archaeological record that indicates this, and there's no evidence he married a Jewish woman. And there is a lot of archaeological records around this period. And so those would be interesting omissions if they had happened. And the other part of it, so this idea that the king signs this edict that all the Jews have to be killed, and then he can't null and void it.
Yeah.
Like, that's, edicts could totally be revoked by the king. Like, he totally had that power. The king had absolute power. So if the king was like, no, I thought you said juice, you know, like something like that. I thought we were getting rid of all the juice in the kingdom. Like, no, get rid of the orange juice, but Esther's people can live. Like, who? I mean, it's fictionalized. Yeah. It's dramatized. It's heightened. And the text really is concerned with diaspora Jews. So diaspora Jews being Jewish folks living outside of Palestine. And since this exile, since the Babylonian exile, more Jews have always lived outside of Palestine than have lived inside of Palestine.
Yep.
Even with the reinstitution of the Israeli state. So it's concerned with people who aren't living in the land, which might be why Jerusalem and the temple and those particular cultic rites tied to the temple aren't present, because for diaspora Jews at the time, maybe they didn't matter. They might have mattered to their moms and dads and grandparents, but maybe not for them. They're so distanced from it that it's a disconnect, maybe.
The temple and those things don't function the same way for Jews in the diaspora, in the same way as it did for the Jews that were still living there.
One of the other things that this particular story does is it gives us an etiology for Purim. And so Purim is a non-religious celebration in the Jewish month of Adar. Is that pronounced right? Or Adar?
Mm-hmm. Adar.
Which is roughly February, March, so I guess about now-ish.
It's coming up next week, I think.
Which we're recording this way earlier than this episode's coming out. So it's coming up a few weeks ago.
Purim already happened by the time you're listening to this.
But it hasn't for us.
Hasn't yet.
Time is relative.
Time travel.
And so this celebration recalls the escape of Jews from a pogrom in the 5th century BCE Persian Empire. So it's giving the etiology for a story, for a celebration that's happening about this story, even though the story is a fictionalized version of whatever this later celebration is. So we celebrate this thing. What's the story of it? Ah, here's Esther. Let's fill it in. So in the story, the name Purim derives from the lots that Haman cast to determine the date of the genocide. So that's Haman wants to kill all the Jews, casts lots to decide when, and picks a date, and that's the name where it comes from. And the festival may have originated from the practice of Persians at their New Year festival to cast lots to predict the fate of the nations. Mm-hmm. Diaspora Jews were likely assimilating to the Gentile culture to some extent. It's impossible not to. They may have participated in this festival when the emphasis gets shifted back to nationalistic concerns of identity building. It gets pulled into the story of Esther for ideological purposes. A major theme of this particular book is irony. So the expected outcome is always reversed. So you expect Esther, who becomes as a humble orphan, you don't expect her to become a powerful queen, mm-hmm. and yet here she is. The Jews, their whole book, the drama of it is they're intended victims of edict of this edict of destruction, but then they end up being the victors in the end. Mm-hmm. Spoiler alert, in case you weren't already familiar with the story. It doesn't happen. And Mordecai, in particular, is singled out for execution by Haman. So Haman builds these gallows to publicly hang Mordecai because he's been humiliated, right? So the king, when he can't fall asleep, I love this. When he can't fall asleep, he has somebody come and read him like the court records. And
the history,
the history. So he'll be bored to sleep, and I'm assuming. And I doubt it's because he's like, I guess I should get some work done.
Turn the history channel on. I want to go to bed.
I want to go to bed. It's the ancient version of the weather channel. And so he's reading this, and he learns that Mordecai has saved his life, and he didn't know that. And so he's like, oh, so he calls in Haman. I'm trying to remember this correctly. Calls in Haman, is like, I want to throw a parade for somebody who saved me or something. And Haman assumes this parade
is
for him,
but it's for Mordecai.
So he plans this ridiculously over the top celebration for this unknown savior of the king. In his mind, it's for him. Yeah. And then the day comes, and he has to, like, march Mordecai through the streets. So he's humiliated by this, even though nobody knows.
Yeah.
He's the only one who thought it was for him and then is disappointed. And so he decides Mordecai has to go. They all got to go, but Mordecai's got to go. So he builds these gallows to publicly hang Mordecai. And then the ironic reversal at the end is that Haman ends up being the one hung on the gallows. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So he constructed his own execution in that sense. One of the particularly interesting ways about that this book is structured, I think, is the use of banquets to structure the book.
Mm-hmm.
So chapter 1, 2 through 4 starts with Ahasuerus's banquet for nobility, and then in 1:5 through 8, we have his banquet for all the men in Susa. And then in 1:9, we have Vashti's banquet for the women. And then 2:18, Esther's enthronement banquet. 3:15, Haman and Ahasuerus have a banquet together. And then Esther in 5:4 through 8 has her first banquet, and her second banquet is in 7:1 through 10. And these are the banquets where she is trying to work up the nerve to tell the king what the issue is. Because she goes before him uninvited, which should have been a death sentence.
Yep.
But he likes her so much.
Aww.
He's smitten. And so he's like, why are you here? And she's like, I just wanted to tell you that I'm having this party.
Do you want to come?
Do you want to come over? Do you want to come? Like, I mean, I know you're my husband, but... and then he comes to the banquet, and she's like, I have something really important to tell you. And he's like, why? And she's like, I'm having another party.
Do you want to come to that one?
Can you come to that party? And he's like, sure. And then on the second banquet, I believe, is when she finally tells him, like, my people are in jeopardy. There has, you know, there's a plot to murder them. And he's like, how has this happened? And she's like, Haman, he's how. And the king believes her. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, he just believes her. And there's no like, well, let's investigate. Just... #believe women. So I said that sarcastically. I meant really hashtag believe women. I said it sarcastically. I'm sorry. So that we have the two banquets that she holds, and then 8:17, the Jews feasting. There's a banquet of the Jews feasting in celebration of Mordecai's glory and the counter decree. And then in 9:17 and 19, we have the first feast of Purim on Adar 14, the date of Adar 14th. And then the second feast of Purim on Adar the 15th is described in 9:18. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of meals.
Yeah.
In this story, which I think in part, I mean, I would be interesting. I didn't do any research to see if anybody's written specifically on the purpose of these meals besides as a structuring device. I mean, people got to eat. There's definitely a sense of extravagance in these feasts, especially with the first ones with the king just trying to impress people. And then Esther's able to throw this banquet just for her and her husband. And Haman, it seems he's present, but it doesn't really, I don't think it indicates that anybody else is really there besides probably some slaves, which the party isn't for them. They're working the party. So I think it's really interesting that there's so much eating in this book. And then there are three surviving editions of the story. So first is the Masoretic text preserved in the Hebrew Bible. So basically you crack open your Bible in your bookshelf, that's the one you're going to be reading.
Yep.
And then there are two Greek texts. So there's a text that's called the Greek A text. It did not receive canonical status in any tradition. It's a translation of a Hebrew original, and it's slightly different than the Masoretic text. So it must not have been notable or ideologically different enough to get canonized by anybody. And then the second or the third surviving text, but the second Greek text, is Septuagint Esther. And it's often just referred to as Greek Esther because it is, it's found in the Apocrypha and it has six additional blocks of material. So it's longer. And so the first block of additional material is a visionary dream of Mordecai. And it foreshadows events to come and contextualizes those events in a cosmic conflict between Jews and Gentiles. The second block is a decree written by Haman. The third block emphasizes the importance of prayer. So Esther is really pious, and she loathes her marriage to a Gentile, and it's therefore kosher. So you can kind of see an editorial hand saying, we need to put some Jesus in there. Not Jesus. Jesus wasn't around yet.
Some God.
Sorry. I got a little too Christian-y up in here. We got to put some God in there. But yeah, I mean, so she's pious. She's kosher. That's got to be in there somewhere. Our fourth block of material, there is a moment where God intervenes in a crucial moment to cool the king's temper and protect Esther. So it seems, so again, inserting God into a story that God wasn't in first, a new character. And then in the fifth block of material is a decree written by Mordecai. And then the sixth block of material is an interpretation of Mordecai's dream and a statement of authentication explaining how the Greek version made it to Egypt. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty interesting with these six additional blocks of material added. So those are the three versions of Esther. Any questions? I'm just kidding.
Take out your pencils.
It's time for a quiz.
Now time for a quiz. Yeah, it's interesting too with the Greek version in that we kind of said that as a little bit that the it inserts God, the name of God, mm-hmm. and there's actually prayer because there's actually really no, I don't think there's prayer in the Masoretic version. So it's adding religious elements that weren't there. And the other crazy thing is that I think there are 270 some verses of Greek Esther, so Septuagint Esther, and like about 100 of those don't even match the Masoretic at all. And so, so back to what we had said in another episode about Qumran and the scrolls and the ways in which the Masoretic, the scrolls, and the Septuagint all kind of play with editions of the text that we don't have anymore, in that it might have... The Septuagint Esther really shows us that whatever Hebrew edition it was working from was probably far more fluid, and meaning it was able to be moved around a lot more than what we have now in the Masoretic. And so... getting back to the fun ideas of orality and the different ways that the story may have been told in communities and the ways in which it existed. And so that there may not just be one version of Esther. So we say Esther and everybody thinks of what's in Hebrew Bible Old Testament, but there's another big version, Septuagint Esther, and there's probably other ones that maybe we'll find, maybe we won't find, that actually treated the story differently. But that also interesting that whatever version the Septuagint was working from, or the editors of the Septuagint version itself, felt the need to make Esther more religious, and that they felt the need to downplay Purim, elevate God, elevate prayer, and those sorts of things. Very different from the Masoretic.
So there was a paper that I heard at a Society of Biblical Literature conference a few years ago. So I don't remember my big details of it. But one of the things is the scholar highlighted, and I can't remember the person's name.
Somebody.
I don't work in Esther too often, so it wasn't something that I thought, like, I'm going to have to come back to this. But here we are. I'm going to have to start coming back to everything. That there's the eunuchs are a really interesting role throughout. And sort of that fluid liminal space that these eunuchs occupy in the story of going into, you know, what's considered masculine and feminine or male and female space. You know, so whenever Vashti's called to come to the banquet at the beginning, she refuses to come in verse 112. The queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, conveyed by the eunuchs. And then the king was enraged and his anger burned within him. So you have these eunuchs who are able to, they served important court functions, and they're intermediaries really at some like critical junctures in the story. So I don't know. I just think that that's really interesting. I mean, they probably were slaves, which means they were possibly forcibly castrated. Not uncommon. Yeah. Especially if they were going to be men working with high-ranking women.
Yeah.
Need to make sure they can't knock her up.
Yeah.
And also the idea was that some forms of castration would limit or totally eliminate a man's ability to function sexually.
Yeah, exactly.
The possibility of
reproducing. Yeah.
I know that by the time we get to Roman times, you know, there were like three ways to cut. I mean, you could cut it all off. You could tie. It's what people do to cows. I don't even have these parts, and it sounds so painful. Tie up the scrotum, and then it'll eventually fall off.
Yep.
Or you could just crush the testicles.
Yep.
And just break it out. And so the purpose of that for slaves, for some purposes, was because you wanted them to stay prepubescent. So they could be your little sex playthings.
Yeah.
So quite disgusting. But then some of it too, without minimizing the sexual abuse that these particular people would have gone through, because it's not an either or, it probably would be a both and, but if they were having to work with women in women's spaces, then we need to make sure that our women are protected. And so... So yeah, these eunuchs, they perform some really interesting functions throughout Esther, and maybe that's something that we'll come back and visit in the future, is the role of these eunuchs throughout the book at these sort of critical junctures, kind of living in this liminal space, not quite male, not quite female, you know, kind of floating in these two different worlds. So this is one of our shorter episodes, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but we'll come back to Esther and we'll talk about, you know, some of the interesting plot points throughout, because there's a lot in here that could be talked about. This, you know, she gives him a gift whenever he's going to choose her, and the text doesn't say what the gift is, but that's like a way that other stories have really, other tellings of this, interpretations of this, have really tried to fill in that blank. And so, I wonder what it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
Maybe it was a rose.
Maybe it was the rose. She gave him the rose.
She gave him the rose.
She's like, I'm taking power. And he was like, oh my gosh, she's so pretty. And like, not dumb. Oh my gosh. Anyway, this has been The Bachelor Mesopotamia. The Bachelor Susa. The Bachelor Susa. Who will Esther's pick? Tune in next week to find out. Okay, I think I'm done being a Valley Girl. That's it. Amen and Selah.